All right, I'm going to start this now.
Traditionally, European wars have been born of land hunger. In the Near East, land is at a discount. It has been estimated that 85% of the surface area in that part of the world is waste, barren. The critical commodity is water. When the Bedouin described his earthly paradise, he imagined Eden, a well-gardened, well-watered garden. When God described to Moses and to the children of Israel the many splendors of the promised land, he listed first its many brooks and deep fountains. More likely than not, war in the Near East is born of thirst, the parched land, of the need for riverbanks, for deep, productive wells. It is not surprising, therefore, that any further major settlement of Jews in the Holy Land in Israel is dependent now upon the tapping of new supplies of fresh water, nor that the undertaking of such projects is the cause for ugly and belligerent threats by the obdurate and unreconstructed enemies of the Jewish state. When the first Halutzim, first settlers, returned to the Holy Land at the beginning of the century, they found there not the biblical land of brooks and fountains, but a blighted, blasted land of desiccated soil, erosion, and sand. One half of the hillside area was bare down to the rock. The coastal rivers were clogged with sedimentary debris. Their waters had backed up to form all manner of malaria-breeding swamps. The desert which in biblical days had begun south of Beersheba, had rolled its dunes through the centuries northward some 50 miles, almost to Tel Aviv. Had God then misrepresented the Holy Land, the Promised Land? Not at all. Over the centuries, man had ravaged what was once a fertile, green and verdant plain. Such is progress that 2,500 years ago, the Holy Land could support 2.5 millions of people and support them at a high standard of existence. Such is progress that 2,500 years ago, over 3,000 square miles of Canaan was arable and under cultivation. At the turn of this century, only 150 square miles was still under cultivation. Farmers had abused the soil. Goat herds had allowed their flocks to crop the foliage without thought to the fact that the roots of these bushes and trees knitted the soil to the living rock. The river drainage schemes were forsaken and forgotten and trampled down by Muslim and Crusader army and horse. You believe in progress. You believe that each year man somehow arrives at a new plateau of existence you have not paused to consider. Palestine. Where there are semi-literate, so-called primitive Bronze Age ancestors had an intricate system of water and land reclamation and conservation. They had a respect for the land, which was not to be found in their latter ancestors, who proceeded to undo, unknit, forsake, destroy all that they had achieved. And it is only in the space age, now, in our own generation, that we have come back to the skill and to the respect for land and fresh water, which these primitives had almost 3,000 years ago. When the Haluksim came to Palestine, they quickly realized that the first priority would have to be a refreshening of the soil, a reclamation of the land resource. They sang, as you know, "We left in tears, we shall return in joy." But there could be no return, no resettlement, no joy, no song, until there was land on which to settle. Land to sow, harvests to reap, water to drink. And so the first priority of Israel's pioneers was to reopen the rivers, and redig the drainage trenches, to clear the hillside and the farm of rock, to rebuild the terracing, to replant and reforest. And this they did. As you know, they performed miracles. In 1920, 150 square miles of Palestine was under cultivation. In 1960, 1,200 square miles of Palestine was under cultivation. In 1920, the land could barely support 180,000 people. In 1960, it could adequately support 2.25 million people. But there were more coming. Each year, 50, 75, 100,000 knocked at the gates. They needed admission. They could not be turned aside. Israel had come to the end of the easily available water resource. The coastal rivers had been used to their full. The cistern system had been developed and cemented and made watertight. Where was new water resource to be found? Well, the Israelis looked longingly. Billions of cubic meters of water which lapped up each year against their long Mediterranean coastline. And their engineers were busy trying to devise methods of leaching and desalinating this sea water. For it was heavy with salt and heavy with chemical. And if this water were put on the ground, the chemicals would erode the fertility of the soil and would blight it and blast it forever. Rudimentary desalination machines have been built, but they are cumbersome, and they are costly, and they cannot yet produce a sufficiently pure water for drink or for agriculture. The scientists say we will provide to you, Israel, the water for the 4th million, but it is the 3rd million which is knocking at the doors. Where is water to be found? The only major source of fresh water, which has not been fully tapped, is the largest river basin of the western Near East, the fabled Jordan River. Jordan River is the least used of all the river resources in that part of the world, and it is little used for an obvious geographic reason. For most of its major course, as it flows southward from the Sea of Galilee to the Dead Sea, it flows in one of the deepest flaws in the Earth's surface. The ancients were never able to pump large quantities of water up and over the high Jordan cliffs. And we moderns have discovered that this deep-lying riverbed is heavily contaminated with chemicals. The Jordan picks up here the carbons and the chemicals which it deposits in the deep sea brine. And so even if we are able to raise electrically, to pump water with generators up and over the cliffs, the water is not fresh. It needs to be purified, and the means are not available. Above the Sea of Galilee, in the short headwaters of the Jordan flows through the most heavily rained-on area of the Near East. In this area, where the Kishon and the Dan come together to form the Jordan, some 40 and more inches of rain fall a year. And so it has never been necessary for the farmers of the area to tap in any major way the headwaters of the Jordan. As long ago as 25 years, agronomists, hydrologists, engineers of all kinds recognized that any major land reclamation in the Transjordan or in the Negev, across the Jordan River or in the south of Israel would depend ultimately upon a major, expensive, and extensive relocation of the waters of the Jordan, the fresh waters, the waters of the Sea of Galilee, a piping of these waters south or east to what is now parched land. Dr. Walter Clay Loudermilk, an American agricultural expert, went to the Near East in the early 1940s, and he blueprinted there what he called the Jordan Valley Authority, a major scheme of dams and dikes and hydroelectric plants and irrigation canals, which he said on purely engineering grounds would be sufficient to provide cheap electrical power for the entire Near East, sufficient fresh water to reclaim 300,000 acres of land, enough land to provide food for an additional 4 million of people. This plan was much heralded, but it required the cooperation of all the nations whose geography was involved in the waters of the Jordan Basin. Then we had the tragedy and the triumph of 1947 and 48, the breakup of the area into bitterly competing states. Dr. Loudermilk's plan was forgotten. But the need to tap the waters of the Jordan was not forgotten. And both of the hungry water-needing kingdoms, Jordanian and the Israeli, went ahead after 1948 to devise their own programs for diverting water. Fearful that any unilateral major water diversion from the Jordan might lead to war in the Near East, President Dwight Eisenhower in 1953 sent Ambassador Eric Johnston to the Near East in order to effect a water rights treaty between Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and Israel. After 3 years of most patient negotiation, the water and agricultural experts of these four nations initialed a draft treaty, a water rights program, which provided to Lebanon, to Syria, and to Jordan all the waters they could possibly need for any conceivable, feasible irrigation project, and to Israel the rights to some 300 million cubic meters of water a year. Not enough for all of Israel's needs, but a major contribution towards land reclamation of a sufficiently large order to allow Israel to say, in the sake of amity and peace, we are satisfied. 3 months later, in October of 1955, the political chiefs of state of the Arab League met in Cairo, and they vetoed this draft treaty. They said that they would not sign any treaty to which Israel was a signatory. They said they would not sign any treaty from which Israel derived any benefit, even though it was pointed out to them that not a single conceivable drop of water more could be used by any of the Arab states affected. They refused to sign this treaty largely, in effect, because Egypt had already concluded a major arms deal with the Soviet Union. And the Arab League was looking forward in 1955 confidently to a victorious second round. But if the Arab states were unwilling to allow Israel to tap the waters of the Jordan, they were not willing to deny themselves that privilege. In 1958, using American foreign aid money and American engineers, the Kingdom of Jordan began to engineer a diversion of a major tributary of the Jordan for its own canal and irrigation needs. It operated within the terms of the Johnston Report. In 1961, the first waters were diverted from the Yarmouk. In 1965, the Yarmouk will, for all intents and purposes, cease to be. Its waters brought south into hungry, thirsty Jordanian land, there to bring to life perhaps 100,000. Israel made no protest. Jordan was operating within the terms of this pencil, but not ratified it. But what is food for the goose is food also for the gander. Israel felt that if with American funds and American know-how, Jordan could go ahead with this type of irrigation project, surely with its own funds, with its own engineers, with its own skill, it should be allowed the same privilege. Beginning in 1958, the Jordan Valley Water Carrier was blueprinted and put into production. This was a major system of canals and pipes designed to draw from the Sea of Galilee 300 million cubic meters of water a year and draw this water south some 100 miles deep into the Negev, there to bring to life perhaps 150,000 acres of dried earth, there to provide for the resettlement of perhaps 500,000 Early spring of this year, the last link in this project will be forged and the waters will begin to flow. With that customary lack of logic and respect for law and for honor and for simple decency which characterizes most of Arab relations with Israel, the imminent conclusion of this Jordan Valley water carrier was hailed by them as an act of aggression, as a casus belli, a cause for war. And they made representation to Washington through oil men and through our embassies, urging that Washington encourage Israel to cease and desist, frightening our ambassadors that if Israel did not at least delay, Arab troops would be on the march. And Washington was far too compromised in its Jordan project to counsel delay on Israel. The council was not forthcoming. And so scimitars were rattled and threats, ugly threats were hurled. And a rather remarkable summit conference of 13 Arab League leaders was held in January of this year in Cairo. This is perhaps one of the most cold-eyed and grisly of conferences ever convened. For here were heads of state who literally, on the day before the conference, were at each other's throats, smiling at each other, coming together in bloodthirst, in hate, for jihad, the holy, or shall we say, the unholy war of Islam. Here was Abdullah al-Salal, the Yemenite puppet of General Nasser. Here was King Saud, who was backing the Iman. The two forces met, meeting the very day of the conference in pitched battle in the mountain fastnesses of Yemen. Here was King Hussein of Jordan in Cairo, the very Cairo from which Nasser, a few months before, had put a price on Hussein's head. And what brought these heads of state together? Not the great economic needs of their respective impoverished nations. War, hate, bitterness, vengeance, anger. But there was to be no jihad. To be no unholy war. But despite their bitterness and their anger, they recognized that the Muslim armies were not at the moment in a position to attack Israel. General Nasser's troops were committed in Yemen, where they were not comporting themselves with conspicuous bravery or success. The Iraqi troops were fully committed against revolting Kurdish tribesmen to the north. Morocco did not trust Algeria, and Algeria did not trust Morocco. Their troops were on each other's borders. Jordan was unwilling to put its troops under the command of Syria. The Syrian generals were jockeying so busily for control of the Syrian government that no one knew who had command of the Syrian army. And so there was no jihad, no holy war. But out of this conference came a three-pronged program whose effects we shall see. The first was a decision to increase the secondary boycott against firms which deal with Israel. A boycott which has been in effect, as you know, for many years, but not with conspicuous success. The second program was a program to build up an Arab Foreign Legion, a group of brigand professionals who would be under some centralized Arab League command, paid for acts of sabotage deep within Israeli borders. And ultimately, it was hoped that a band of professional Hessians would be brought together who would lead the third round, the hopefully successful round, to destroy Israel. And finally, it was voted to use oil royalty monies to divert in Lebanon and in Syria two of the major headwaters of the Jordan, so that these rivers, instead of spilling into the Jordan basin, would be detoured and turned and spill hopefully helplessly out into the Mediterranean Sea. This is a pointless project, a project which will involve hundreds of millions of dollars, a project which will bypass three expensive hydroelectric projects now in being in Lebanon, built by American foreign aid money. Such is the temper of our world, and such is the anger of the Arab world, that this diversion may very well take place. Its only constructive purpose, the lowering of the water level in the Sea of Galilee, so that presumably Israel could not draw as much water or as pure water down into the Negev for irrigational purposes. It's a mad, mad world we live in. And I'm often asked, why is it, Rabbi, that though you speak for a peace-loving tradition, why is it that you are not a pacifist? Here's my answer. If Israel depended upon unilateral disarmament, upon the goodwill of the world below, there would be no Israel. When there is a madman in the street and there is no policeman, you had better be prepared to defend yourself. Peace, unfortunately, must sometimes be bought at the price of preparedness. The pathology, and that is all we can call it, the pathology of this conference was underlined by the eminently wise and understanding response of the Israeli Prime Minister, Mr. Eshkol, who reaffirmed Israel's determination to complete, within the terms of the Johnston Agreement, the Jordan Valley water carrier, and then added these words: this area needs the benefits that will flow from the waters and not incitement to bloodshed. It needs economic development, not barren strife, cooperation, not envious hostility. The utilization, not the waste, of its water resources. The advancement of peace, and not the fomenting of war. But what is there that will advance the cause of peace in the Near East? Obviously, arms, preparedness, the strength of Israel's defense forces can only buy time. It cannot affect political solutions. Some among our Western diplomats seem to have the pious and, in my opinion, misguided hope that with prosperity, with the large ingestion of American and Russian and German and Czechoslovak and French and British capital, with prosperity, the Arab leaders will have a change of heart. I doubt it. The Arab states are certainly far more prosperous today than they were 16 years ago when Israel was founded, but they are, if anything, more determined to blot Israel off of the map. A new generation of Arab children from Dakar to Malaysia, from Morocco to the farthest corners of the world, has been raised in hate. And the religion, which might be a mediating force, a force to impose a moral change of heart, the religion, Islam, committed to blot out these interlopers, these Westerners, these colonialists, Zionists, these Jews. What then? I believe that there can be, if not a change of heart, a change of mind. I believe that the Arab leaders are, above all else, realists. And I believe that if the major powers of the world, United States is preeminent among these, that if the major powers of the world will guarantee the present borders of the Near East against any act of aggression by any power. The Arab leaders will soon learn to let be. President Kennedy knew this. 1960, when he was still a senator, President Kennedy, in a public address, encouraged the United States government to make such a clear and definite commitment that if any act of aggression took place in the Near East, the United States was prepared both within and without the United Nations to make a direct and immediate response. The integrity of Israel and of her neighbors, Senator Kennedy then said, was a matter vital to the security of the United States. And in March of last year, the now president said, the United States supports social and economic and political progress in the Middle East. We support the security of Israel and of her neighbors. We strongly oppose the use of force or the threat of force in the Near East. And we also seek to limit the spread of communism in the Near East, which would, of course, destroy the independence of these people. In the event of direct or indirect aggression, we would support all appropriate courses of action in the United Nations or on our own to prevent or to put a stop to such aggression. There you have it. But you say to me, Rabbi, that's precisely the point. The pledge has been made, and yet there is no peace. The words have been spoken, the guarantees have been given, but they are pointless. They've been of no effect. And I would answer you, yes. The words have been spoken. They have not been heard. The words have been spoken, but they have not been believed. And General Nasser has good reason not to believe these words. In 1954, President Eisenhower was determined to prevent an arms race in the Near East. The term then was the escalation of the arms race in the Near East. And so he imposed with our NATO allies a de facto arms embargo. And he said, abide by this embargo, and we will support your economic development. Israel abided the embargo. General Nasser in 1955 signed an arms deal with the Soviet Union. The very deal was precipitated the Suez campaign. The United States continued the de facto arms embargo, which now worked only to the detriment of Israel, and the United States continued pouring tens of millions of dollars every month into the Egyptian economy. General Nasser learned early that American words were not always to be taken at their surface meaning. In 1956, after the successful Suez campaign, Israel was promised by the United Nations and guaranteed by the United States that if it would withdraw its troops from the Sinai Peninsula, the right of free passage through the Suez Canal would be granted to it. In 8 years, not a single Israeli ship has been permitted through the canal. And in those 8 years, over $1 billion of unrestricted aid has been poured into General Nasser's economy. Nasser knows full well that American guarantees need not be taken at their paper value. In 1962, the United States warned General Nasser not to peddle the socialist revolution in the Yemen. And he sent his troops. We continued to pour $200 million a year of aid into the Egyptian economy, a significant figure, because it is precisely $200 million a year which is required by the expeditionary troops of General Nasser to maintain their position. General Nasser knows that between the clear guarantees, presumably spoken, and the act, the commitment, there can be many delays. And much advantage can be taken of these delays. Not once in 15 years has he been penalized for a single aggressive act, for a single violation of his commitments to the United States. Not once in 15 years, through the gifting of millions and billions of dollars to his economy, have we been willing to place a single restriction in our gifts. When in September of last year, the Senate of the United States finally became tired of the obduracy and the obstinacy and the ego of the man, and insisted that any further foreign aid to General Nasser must be tied to certain restrictions, that to receive this aid he must guarantee the freedom of Israeli shipping in the canal, that to receive this aid he must guarantee the withdrawal of his troops from the Yemen, that to receive this aid he must guarantee to have no aggressive designs against Israel, our State Department simply announced that they would not be bound by these senatorially agreed upon past restrictions because they were not in the best interests of the United States. And there you have it. The word, how the words are understood. The words are good. Yet President Kennedy was correct. His assessment was accurate. The words need to be spoken. But they need to be spoken in a way which is consistent, such a way as the Arab states will know that we mean to abide by these commitments. I would call on President Johnson to reconfirm this guarantee of last May. And I would call upon President Johnson furthermore to agree with the Senate that restrictions ought to be placed on any further gift of money to Egypt or to Syria or to Jordan, or for that matter to Israel. Guarantees that none of these states have aggressive designs against any other. Guarantees that they will not engage in an arms race with each other. Guarantees that they will not permit saboteurs or fellaheen infiltrators to be quartered within their borders. Guarantees that they will sit down and negotiate. For ultimately, there is no issue between Israel and her neighbors which cannot be negotiated. We need this guarantee. This is the way of peace. It is in the best interests of our own beloved nation to make such a guarantee. For ultimately, war in the Near East will in all probability ignite a major war. Ultimately, war in the Near East can only exacerbate world tensions, can only destroy domestic peace. Ultimately, war in the Near East can only weaken the one bastion of democracy there, Israel. I believe that President Johnson will reiterate this guarantee. I hope and pray that he will have sufficient control of his administration to see to it that in words and in deeds, the State Department, the foreign aid officials, the diplomats, make clear to the Arab state that these words mean precisely what they say, that any wanton and willful act of aggression against Israel will be understood as an act which is unfriendly to the interests of the United States. We read this morning the story of the well of bitterness, when a wandering, wilderness-bound people found themselves short of water and cried out against Moses and against God for having given them over to such things. They lacked confidence. They were punished for that lack of confidence. We need not lack confidence. Israel's armies have given her time. The water carrier will bring further greenness to the land and permit the in-migration of tens of thousands of people. And I believe we can have confidence, too, that the American people, the American legislators, our president, are coming more clearly to recognize the terms of conflict in the Near East. when one deals with obstinacy and anger and hatred, one must deal with strength and one must protect the civilized and the decent. That is, after all, the American way and the American creed. I think they will come to realize that this year now, clear guarantees can properly be given, and that once those guarantees have been given, slowly but inexorably, tensions will recede, passions will cool, peace will come, the land will grow green, and the peoples of the land will be able to harvest the new opportunity, the new prosperity which is